if I touch on something that you'd rather not get into, just say so. We'll cut the whole exchange out. But it also seems like you're pretty open about a lot of things.
Yeah. I am having trouble imagining anything that you could talk to me about.
I know. What are we going to throw Amanda Knox with? It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. A lot of people who appear on our show might already be familiar to you before you hear the interview. You've seen them on television or in movies. You've heard their music on the radio. You know their name. You might know Amanda Knox's name as well, but it's not from entertainment. In 2007, Amanda was an American college student from Seattle studying in Italy when her roommate, Meredith Kircher, was murdered. Amanda and her Italian boyfriend, Raffaella Solicito, were arrested and charged with the crime. 2 years later, they were convicted of murder. This was after a man named Rudy Gadet had already also been convicted of killing Meredith Kircher. Amanda Knox and Raffaella Solicito's convictions were overturned in 2011, and Amanda returned to Seattle. A new trial was ordered, and the two were convicted again in 2014, before that conviction was overturned and the two were exonerated a year later in 2015. If you have never heard of this case, I am surprised. If you want more details, try the internet, but try to stick with your more reputable sources, because this situation got talked about all over the world, especially in tabloid journalism. There have been plenty of wrongful convictions in the world, of course, but this one got talked about a lot because it had young, attractive people, murder, sexual relationships were discussed at great length, and of course, at the heart of it all are human beings. Can you imagine going through something like this, where you're very young, your roommate is murdered, you sit in a jail in a foreign country for years, you're convicted, then cleared, then convicted, then cleared, all while reporters from around the world pick apart every aspect of your life? Can you imagine your name forever being shorthand for a horrifying crime you did not commit? Because I can't imagine that. And in the nearly 7 years since her exoneration, I've been wondering how Amanda Knox goes about the process of moving forward. How does she heal? Amanda Knox has not been cleared of a conviction of slander against Patrick Lumumba, her boss at a bar where she worked in Italy. Amanda implicated him during her interrogation. She says it was a coerced statement that the police threatened her. She was then charged with slandering the police and then acquitted. If you can't keep track of all that, I understand, I get it, but I wanted to mention it because she does talk about the slander charge in this interview, and also because it just gets so complicated, the whole situation. Amanda Knox has been speaking out lately, in part to denounce a Matt Damon movie that was based on her story. She's also the host of a podcast called Labyrinths with her husband, Christopher Robinson. It's about the personal mazes and dead ends and shortcuts people navigate in their lives. Amanda has a new baby daughter also. Amanda joined me from her home in Seattle. I was going to ask you, what was it like after everything in Italy was over, but then I couldn't figure out when that would actually be defined as over. Would it be when you returned from Italy? Would it be when the final exoneration was declared? Or is it over? How do you stand on the idea of all that being done with?
Right. Well, I think that there are some important non-negligible changes that have occurred. So the difference between being in prison and not being in prison is huge, no doubt. Does that mean that the trials were over? No. In a very real way, they were not. And in fact, I continued to be on trial for another 4 years. I was facing extradition. I was facing the possibility of being imprisoned. I was in conversations with lawyers here in the United States trying to figure out if there was a way, if I were found guilty and definitively sentenced, if I could serve my sentence here in the United States as opposed to abroad, so far away from my family. So in a very real sense, I was technically free in the sense that I was not in a prison cell, but I was absolutely not free for a number of years following my release from prison. And then it's also non-negligible and very real to be on trial versus not on trial. And today I am not on trial. I remain wrongly convicted of slander. So that's, you know, a little known factoid is I was never actually definitively acquitted of slander. So the course of an illegal interrogation, regardless of being found to be illegal and that my rights had been violated, I still remain technically guilty. Like several years of my imprisonment are deemed are like earned or deserved due to that conviction, which is deeply, deeply hurtful and painful for me personally. And then, of course, yes, there's an important difference to be no longer having to have conversations with lawyers where I'm having to talk about what the legal status of the case is. I don't have to talk about the case on a day-to-day basis if I don't want to. That said, it still remains a situation where the allegation remains attached to me to this day in the court of public opinion. Whether or not you think I'm innocent or guilty, I remain considered the central figure in a case that actually has nothing to do with me. I remain like the legacy of this tragedy and this atrocity rests largely on my shoulders and not on the shoulders of the man who actually committed this crime. So in that way, it's not over. And having to psychologically navigate those different stages of my experience have been challenging, and I've had to adapt for sure.
So when you talk about the slander issue still being out there, when you were finally acquitted for the last time, that's when in the movie, everybody hugs and the credits roll and everything's, you know, everything's taken care of. What was your mental state at that point when that verdict came down?
Well, so of course, that was a huge, huge relief in the sense that even at that time, so we're talking about me being definitively acquitted, no longer on trial for murder.
2015.
In 2015, I was here in the United States, so I was being tried in absentia. I had recently been reconvicted, so I technically, like the best possible outcome that I was expecting from the Italian Supreme Court was for them to reverse that conviction and send me back for trial again. So in 2015, my best hopes were that I would be tried again, not that I would be acquitted and definitively released from this burden of being tried. And so when the verdict came in, it was, first of all, I was watching on Italian like live streaming news channels because, of course, my attorneys were in court and couldn't, you know, text me in court what was going on. So my first, you know, the first news that I got was from Italian television, and I saw the verdict come in. I was utterly shocked because, again, was not expecting such a definitively positive result that the Italian Supreme Court would exercise their right to just hand down their own verdict in a case. Usually they just either approve or deny the verdicts that were handed to them from lower court levels. And so I gasped, like the realization that it was over was something I was not expecting in that moment. And the relief, like, and the relief also for Raffaele, because like on the one hand, here I was in the United States wondering if I was going to be fighting an extradition battle. That was what I was thinking was potentially one of the results of this verdict was, am I going to be now fighting an extradition battle? Do I have to turn myself in to the police here in the United States? What's going to happen to me? But meanwhile, my co-defendant, Raffaele, who is just as innocent as I am, is in Italy, and he is wondering if he is going to be arrested imminently. And so Emil, just this huge wave of relief that I wasn't being hunted down anymore, and that Raffaele wasn't being hunted down anymore, the idea that we no longer had to constantly live our lives looking over our shoulder, wondering when the axe was going to fall. Like, that was a tremendous relief. And it opened up like this opportunity for us to think about our lives in a more proactive way instead of a reactive way.
Was there post-traumatic stress up to that point? Was there post-traumatic stress after that point?
I just recently heard a really good term for this, because post-traumatic stress sort of gives the impression that it's like in the past and that you're having traumatic stress afterward, after the trauma. But I've heard this term more recently, peritraumatic stress. So stress due to ongoing trauma. So that you're experiencing while you are still in the midst of the trauma. I feel like I was and have been to this day experiencing peritraumatic stress, because this thing is not behind me. And I'm not able, like, not that I'm not able, I'm still on a path of reclaiming my identity and my life so that I am no longer having to be perpetually answering for a crime that I didn't commit.
So the trauma is still unfolding. You're currently undergoing a kind of chronic or chronic complex trauma.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that I think a lot of people don't like to think about when it comes to wrongful convictions. We like to think that as soon as you've been exonerated and you're out of prison, that the trauma is over. But what is actually true is that the stigma of an accusation remains with you forever, like it seemingly. And furthermore, the life that you lost is something that you have to be able to learn how to grieve. The person you would have been and the life that you would have led were it not for some totally unjust and out of the blue accusation coming and like taking over your life, not just impacting you, but taking over your life, is something that not only I, but a large number of wrongfully convicted people deal with. And it's what helps is, with all trauma, acknowledgement that something is real and that you're not crazy for feeling the way that you feel. And I think that in some ways, the renaissance of true crime interest and documentaries and podcasts and all of that have made it possible for people for the first time to really put themselves in the shoes of individuals who are on trial and to consider like all of the consequences of allegations. And at the same time, it also continues and perpetuates the trauma, because as soon as there's interest in an accusation in a court case, well, that means that that is the interest that you have in that human being and not, for instance, say, in their immediate personal experience or subjective experience, but rather through the lens of accusation, did they or didn't they, kind of thing.
What form does that take for you then? I mean, we think of classic PTSD. We think of somebody whose mind is trying to kind of finally process what's happening. And so it's kind of running it through the system again and again and again, hoping to finally break through and process it. But in the meantime, it's often associated with triggers, you know, the fight, flight, or freeze response. Somebody sets off fireworks at a 4th of July, and somebody who's a combat veteran has an instinct to do something, mm-hmm. and it affects mm-hmm. behavior. How does it manifest with you?
Great question. Different ways and different ways in different time periods of my life. So one that immediately comes to mind is that I have internalized a lot of self-blame, because there's been a lot, like, again, this is super common in wrongful convictions. There's a lot of blame put on the person who is the victim of the wrongful conviction, that it's their fault that it happened to them. It's not the police's fault. The police had no choice but to suspect you and imprison you. Like, it's your fault that you were a suspicious person, and therefore all this bad stuff happened to you because of you. And it sort of strips the agency of the people who are doing the wrongfully convicting, and puts the blame on the person who has suffered the consequence of it. of other people's bad actions. And for a long, long time, everyone blamed me. Everyone. Everyone was like, well, you know, she's guilty, therefore she deserves what she's going through, or she's innocent, but she's a quirky person who everyone understandably thought was guilty, therefore it's her fault. Very much like the she was wearing a short skirt, what did she think was going to happen kind of situation. And in that situation, when that is the predominant narrative that you hear about yourself from the vast majority of human beings, you can't help but internalize some of that blame. And it took me a long time to understand how I was wrongly convicted, why I was wrongly convicted, and how much of that was truly my fault. And the more that I've looked into wrongful convictions cases, the more I realized that I had very, very little agency and control over what was happening to me. And it's even not as much of my fault as I thought it was for a long time. Like even just, for instance, like the sort of outcome of interrogations, there's a lot of self-blame for people who sign or say implicating statements. And there's a lot of self-blame because it's really counterintuitive for people to understand what it's like to be coerced into implicating yourself.
And physically beaten in your case, too.
Yeah, I was slapped. I was psychologically abused. I was lied to. I was brought to the brink of my own sanity. And for a long time, I felt like that was my fault, that there was something wrong with me. And what I've discovered from the research is that there's nothing wrong with me. There's something wrong with the way that we interrogate people and the way that police are allowed to lie to you and to pressure you and to break down your will and your sense of sanity in order to render you vulnerable and suggestible. So that's what's wrong.
Yeah. Well, you know. So that's interesting because you've been very clear as far back as I could remember hearing your name that it is wrong to blame me for this. I did not do this. And then over the years, you were obviously the one people put the microphone in front of the most to say that. And it's true, obviously, and it's rationally true, it's logically true. But I hear you saying that underneath that, there was almost a conscious versus subconscious voice saying, yeah, but I deserve it though. Yeah, this is all my fault, which is so consistent with a variety of mental illness issues, depression or anxiety or eating disorders. Like, yeah, no, I really am trash. And it's not the voice that you would say publicly. It's not even what you might think when you're clear headed, but the voice is still there.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. Like you can know that voice is lying to you even, and it's still there. Like you can't make that voice go away, especially when the world is repeating what that voice is saying. So I think that that's one way that I've experienced it. Other ways are like you brought up triggers, right? Like I remember going like maybe a year or so after I was released from prison, I was invited to go to the Seattle International Film Festival and to see an Italian film. And I went to watch the Italian film. I was a little bit nervous because not because it was an Italian film, but because I was going to be in a room full of strangers. I was not in a space at that point of feeling comfortable around people I didn't know. So just being in public in general was one of those ways that my trauma manifested itself. I just for a long, long time did not feel comfortable in public and did not feel comfortable, especially in public crowds. I still feel uncomfortable with that to this day. And I went to this theater thinking, okay, it's going to be a dark room. We're all watching a movie. No one's going to be looking at me. I sit down. I start watching the film. I discover that the film is in Napoletano dialect. And Napoletano dialect is a very like classic dialect in Italy. It's what you would hear in like classic sort of lounge singery, like schmoozy songs. Like those are often in a Napoletano dialect. But my exposure to Napoletano dialect was exclusive to prison. When I was living in Perugia, I never talked to anyone who used Napoletano dialect. But there were lots of people in prison who spoke with Napolitano dialect. And so when I started hearing that dialect in the film, and particularly when I heard the phrase affacciati, which is what the guards or other prisoners would say to me to come to the cell door, it means like affacciati means like face me, basically, like, you know, show your face. And that I had only ever heard that within the context of me having to go up to the bars of my cell to respond to someone who was asking to see me. And I had an immediate panic attack. I started hyperventilating. I started feeling really claustrophobic, and I had to leave the theater because I couldn't handle it.
Coming up, Amanda Knox looks for therapy, and the results are not great. Back with Amanda Knox, I asked her if she tried to find a therapist after she was finally cleared of the murder charges.
Yeah, I did. And I've not had excellent luck in that regard, because I feel like I've tried twice, and actually, no, three times, three different separate occasions with three separate professional psychologists who could talk to me. And the first time I went was very, very shortly after I got home. I was still living in my mom's house, and I was washing my underwear in the sink, and my childhood bedroom was full of all of my things that I had when growing up, like all my stuffed animals and all my books from when I was a kid. And having been in an environment where I was only allowed to have like a certain number of items in my possession, in prison, when I came home, I felt like I was just surrounded by stuff. And I started trying to get all the stuff out of my room, because I almost felt claustrophobic by stuff at that point. And so I was like putting all of this like memorabilia from my life into like garbage bags, because I was like, I just can't deal with all this stuff. And my mom was like secretly sort of putting all that stuff and all those garbage bags into the garage so that I wouldn't like... She was like, you're having a moment. You're like clearly struggling. And she invited me to go speak to a trauma specialist who reached out and offered services for free. And I remember being resistant because, again, I didn't trust anyone. Like, I'd spent the last 4 years being told by my lawyers to not speak to anyone about my feelings about the case at all. And so I had deeply, deeply buried all of those feelings and thoughts inside of myself and gotten used to the idea that my suffering was not something that I could share with anyone, because my suffering could be exploited by other people. And so I went into that conversation with this person because my mom asked me to. And it was funny. I thought, like, I'm fine. I'm out of prison. Like, why do I need to talk to somebody? And I sat down in front of this guy, very nice guy. All he said was, "So, what would you like to talk about?" And
no.
I lost it. I didn't even say a single word. I just started bawling. And then I got up. I said, I eked out, "I'm sorry," and I left. And I never saw that person again. And it was like, you know, a few years before I tried again. And again, like some of the things, again, this feeling of like being afraid of being exposed and exploited because of my suffering. The second time I went in to speak to a professional therapist, it was not someone who was offering their services for free. So I was thinking, okay, how am I going to pay for this person? It's like $100 an hour or something like that. And I decided against, using health insurance because I was afraid that someone could find out if I used my health insurance, someone could find out that I was talking to a therapist, and then they would accuse me of being a crazy person. Because of course I'm accused of being a psychopath, and I the fear of being exposed as someone who was struggling was deep and not paranoid, because again, like, as I was in this sort of peri-trauma stress, I was on the daily feeling like the spotlight was on me, and any crack that I could show was going to be exploited by tabloid media in order to continue to vilify me. So I was going to these very secretive, just like under the table, $100 bill conversations with this therapist. And I did that for about 3 months before I determined that I wasn't getting what I was hoping out of it, because I felt like nobody knew what to say to me. It's not that I wasn't aware of the trauma. It's not that I wasn't aware of how I was being triggered. It's not that I didn't even have strategies for coping with it. I had all of those things already. The thing that I felt was alone. I still in many ways often feel like my experience is so unique that no one really knows what to say to me, what it feels like to be me, and doesn't know why I react to the world in the way that I do. And of course, I'm not alone. There are lots of wrongfully convicted people. And whenever I meet up with wrongfully convicted people, it's always such a relief, because there's this sense of like feeling understood and not feeling like I have to explain myself all the time. But on the other side of it is, there aren't that many wrongfully convicted people who have been so vilified by the international media for such an extended period of time, whose stories have been exploited to the extent that mine have been exploited, turned into novels and movies, and having my identity not just erased, but usurped. Like, people use it, people exploit it, people. So it's like there is still this sense of feeling a little bit alone, and like nobody really knows how to talk to me about everything, except so in a certain way, I almost feel like I have to therapize myself. I have to big sister myself through my own experience a lot of the time.
Well, that's a tall order. I mean, what were you doing during this time when you see these therapists sporadically? Were you working? Were you living with your mom? Like, what was your life like during that stretch?
Yeah. So the first time I was, that first like 1 second encounter, I was still living with my mom. I was attempting to, like, this was like fresh out of prison, like maybe 2 weeks after I got home. So the next step for me at that point was trying to reestablish a sense of having a path in my life. And at that time of my life, I felt like I should be able to just go back to the life that I had before all of this happened. That I had this sort of idea in my mind that this traumatic event happened to me. It had put my life on pause. And now that it was, you know, quote, over, I was free, I should be able to go back to living the same life that I was living before. That's what I had been waiting for. That's what I kept thinking of for 4 years, was I'm just going to go back to the life that I had before. That's all I want. And what I slowly and painfully discovered upon returning home was that that life no longer existed. And that not only had the world changed around me, the world no longer reacted to me in the same way that they did before, but also I had changed. Despite my best efforts to not be, you know, impacted by the experience, I had changed. Now there were certain things that I knew about the world and the criminal justice system and human nature that made me sensitive and gave me perspective that was valuable to me, that I felt was worthy of sharing with people. So I started to then grasp that, thinking, okay, what happened to me is not just this like horrible thing. I also have the ability to make the best of a bad situation, to take the perspective that I've gained and apply it. Like, okay, I'm applying what I've learned to the world in the best way I possibly can. That's how I got into a career of journalism, which I continue to this day with my podcast Labyrinths that I produce and host with my husband, Christopher. So applying what I've learned to the world and to other people's stories was very, very cathartic for me and was a way for me to process my own experience. And so in a way, my work became not just my work, but my therapy. But then, you know, as time went on, grief is an interesting thing where you think you have a handle on it and then it takes on a new shape and then you have to learn how to hold it again. And those were certain times where I sought out professional help again. So like the second time I had broken up with my boyfriend, I was feeling adrift. Like I had recently graduated from college. So like I had gone on that path of going back to what was familiar to me, school, but now I graduated and now I had the sort of shock of like, well, now I have to be an adult in the world. And does the world want me? Where am I accepted in the world? What kind of job can I have? Can I have a normal job? No. Well, how do I invent a job for myself then? All of that sort of pressure made me feel like I should talk to someone just to see if there was any way that I could better grasp my emotions around that. And that wasn't super successful because, again, I felt like the person sitting across from me didn't really know what to say. And then finally, the most recent time that I've talked to a therapeutic professional was recently, just for, you know, again, like I'm a mom now, and that puts a lot of things into perspective. And it is a challenge to, like, one of the sort of new ways that grief has manifested itself and changed shape, and now I have to adapt to it, is how do I and can I protect my daughter from what happened to me? And that's something that is really, really difficult because I don't have a lot of external recourse. No, I don't have a lot of legal recourse. Instead, I have to sort of slowly build in my daughter a kind of mental and emotional resilience and adaptability to whatever it is that may come her way, and be able to communicate to her my experience in an age-appropriate way, which is a whole new challenge. And so thinking about that has certainly added a new extra dimension of peri-traumatic stress to the situation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would imagine that at some point, I mean, she's very, very young, your daughter, correct? She's fairly newly born.
And, oh, yeah. I'm anticipating.
Yeah. Well, and congratulations on
thank you.
Your daughter. It's a wonderful thing. But yeah, I mean, I'm just sitting here thinking, like, do you reach a point where you say, some people thought that I hurt someone, even though I didn't? And I, you know, like.
I don't know. You tell me. Like, here's another one of those great questions. Like, is there a professional who has ever had to think about this problem before? Or am I, like, one of the first people who's ever had to think, like, how do I explain to my kid that somebody thinks that I am a monster? Like, how do I do that?
Right. And how do you define terms that they can understand going in?
Right. And how do I talk about justice and, like, fairness and how all of those, like, concepts are not just black and white to me. They are very, very sophisticated. Those are not just throwaway terms for me. They are deeply, deeply heavy terms for me.
Well, I mean, how do you talk about it in a way that doesn't scare the hell out of a kid? That, that you know, maybe somebody will think I made a mistake and then I'm going to have to go. It's a little like talking about, is something like mental illness, like, is this going to come get me? Is this, you know, is this a threat to me?
Yeah.
You published a memoir in 2013 And mm-hmm. it immediately struck me like, oh, wow, that's when that came out. But that was still a ways off from that final exoneration.
Oh, yeah.
And presumably there were interviews, there was publicity. How did that go in terms of your mental health? How did you hold up for that?
So that was a really important thing for me, because I knew even coming out of this experience that I was going to have to, or at least I wanted to, I really wanted to add my one voice to like this world of voices who were talking about who I was and what my experience was. So I wanted to say, well, here's my voice. Here's me finally giving my version of the events, my take on things, so that no one could be putting words in my mouth for me, or like, you know, psychoanalyzing me from afar. Like, there is a record of my perspective. And I felt like that was a really important part of my ability, even just to reintegrate back into society, because I knew that there was this incredible thirst for Amanda Knox content. And also, there was a lot of speculation about my mental state and what I was like as a person. And so I felt like I wanted to have a voice in my own experience. And so I went on that journey of telling my story in memoir. It was a good decision, because a memoir takes a while to write. It took me about between 9 months and a year, I guess. And so it allowed me time to be very purposeful about articulating my experience to myself and aspects of my experience that I hadn't yet articulated to myself, just because in the prison environment, there's a state of hypervigilance that sets in, and so you can't really indulge in feelings of pain. Like, I was not allowed, but I didn't allow myself to feel angry about what I was going through while I was in prison, because I felt like anger would compromise my ability to survive in a prison environment. So once I was no longer under the various threats that come with living in prison, I was suddenly having access to emotions that I wasn't expecting to experience, such as anger.
Is that a one-to-one proposition? So, like, is it everything that was repressed while you were in prison came out once you were out of prison?
Well, and it not necessarily like just came out because I was out of prison, but came out because I was very purposefully articulating my experience and all of the feelings that arise from just telling those individual things that happened. Like, if you're trying to describe what it's like for a prison guard to tell you that you're HIV positive and you're probably going to die and you should write down all the people that you had sex with in order to figure out who gave it to you, and only to find out that they lied to you and then sent out your list of people that you'd ever had sex with to the tabloids. Like, there's a lot of anger that comes with like revisiting that memory. Whereas, like, as you're living it, you're just sort of stuck in like the surreal shock of that experience. So looking back on it, you can have different emotions about it than you would have while you were in the midst of it.
Just ahead, Amanda's story inspires a Matt Damon movie, and she's not happy about it.
We are the host of My Brother and Me, and now, nearly 10 years into our podcast, the secret can be revealed. All the clues are in place, and the world's greatest treasure hunt can now begin.
Embedded in each episode of My Brother and Me is a micro clue that will lead you to 14 precious gemstones all around this big, beautiful blue world of ours.
So start combing through the episodes. Let's say starting at episode 101 on.
Yeah, the early episodes are pretty problematic, so there's no clues in those episodes.
No, not at all.
The better ones, the good ones, clues ahoy.
Listen to every episode repeatedly in sequence. Laugh if you must, but mainly get all the great clues. My Brother and Me, it's an advice show, kind of, but a treasure hunt mainly. Anywhere you find podcasts or treasure maps, My Brother and Me, the hunt is on.
For over a decade, Max FunCon has been an incredible weekend of learning, connecting, and laughing with folks in the Max Fun community. And, if all goes according to plan, the last regularly scheduled Max FunCon will take place in Lake Arrowhead from June 3rd to June 5th, 2022. We have a very limited number of tickets remaining. To make them available to the maximum number of people, we'll be opening our waitlist for tickets on January 23rd at 5 p.m. Pacific. That'll be your chance to be first in line to purchase tickets, and we'll go down the waitlist until we're at capacity. More details at maxfuncon.com. And mark your calendars for Sunday, January 23rd at 5 p.m. Pacific.
Back with Amanda Knox, last year the movie Stillwater was released. It starred Matt Damon and was inspired by Amanda's story, but not made with her cooperation or permission.
Matt Damon played a kind of my dad character. So it was from the perspective of an American man whose daughter is wrongly convicted abroad. So the idea being, here's this, you know, young American girl who's caught up in a sex scandal, murder trial abroad. The father is an American man who goes and tries to uncover who really committed the crime in order to rescue his daughter.
Okay.
And spoiler alert, he rescues her, but only comes to find out that actually she is indirectly responsible for the crime. So the issue that I took with Stillwater and that I've taken with other fictionalizations or based on a true story versions of my case is that, first of all, they're taking the most salacious version of the story and recycling it over and over again. So that is like that version of the story, which is the prosecution's case against me, that I'm like some sort of weird person who was either directly or indirectly involved in my friend's murder. That lie is being recycled over and over again and reinforces that image of me in people's minds. And secondly, that people sort of hide behind this idea that because it's fictionalized, then they can take whatever liberties they want with how that story is told, and there should be no consequences to me, but they can also sell that story using my name. And this is not the first time that I've tried to bring people's attention to this problem of how, like, my identity and the idea of my story is constantly exploited by others, and it is at my expense. I've tried to point that out before. It seemed to resonate more with this Matt Damon when I pointed it out about Stillwater because it was so blatant. Like, all of the interviews that were promoting this film were like, oh, yeah, based on the Amanda Knox story, you may recognize Amanda Knox in this character. Oh, like, here's an interesting new retelling of the Amanda Knox story. And people assumed, common sense assumption that because my name was being associated with this piece of art, that I was a part of it, that I was participant, that I had consulted on it, or at the very least was compensated for how they had used my story to tell this story. And of course, none of that is true. Like, no one ever asks me, consults with me. And so my point was, well, actually, in the real world, real people's stories can get exploited all the time, and there's no recourse for it. Like, the only thing I can do is suggest to these people who are empowered to go out and tell stories and make lots of money from it that maybe, just maybe, they should consider their source material when they do so. And that maybe, just maybe, they might owe something to that person, be it just acknowledgement that they are exploiting your story. Like, I wanted to start a conversation about the ethics of storytelling and whether or not we should reconsider how individual human stories are exploited by the big mainstream players who don't really give a thought to those source materials.
When you spoke up about Stillwater and it got picked up, it got carried, people were talking about it, and there was a lot of support for you. Did that have a positive effect on your mental health and your dealing with the trauma?
Honestly, yes. Like, I have been in tears over the idea that somehow somebody is actually recognizing what I'm saying. Because for a long time, I have I've been talking about this. I've been talking about how it's unfair that to this day, I'm the one who bears the infamy of another man's crime. I'm the one who is constantly exploited and turned into a character in other people's stories and is never, ever, ever considered or consulted in the process. Like, I've been talking about how unfair that is and how deeply hurtful and a sort of continued trauma, like, for me that is, and something that causes me a lot of stress that I have to then psychologically adapt to. Like, that's taken a lot of work for me. And one of the painful parts of that is feeling like no one either recognizes it or cares when they see it. And when I finally wrote that Atlantic article, trying to articulate why that was such a betrayal and why I felt like my humanity was completely overlooked, and it actually resonated with people, and people were reaching out to me saying, you know what, this has really given me food for thought. I felt, again, a similar kind of relief to be, like, in the same kind of way that it's like, it's vindicating. It's vindicating for someone to say, you are not crazy for feeling hurt by this. And in fact, if I were in your shoes, I would feel hurt by this too. So that has been deeply, deeply wonderful for me. And it's also been like this interesting turning point as well, where I feel like for the longest time, people have wanted me to exist in a very, very specific box. Like, Amanda Knox, girl who was accused of murder, is what people have been pushing me and pressuring me to limit myself to. You are someone we get to talk about. You are not someone who gets to talk about your own experience. You are tabloid trash. You have nothing valuable to say unless you are being asked, did you or did you not do it? Like, that's, for the longest time, I have been treated that way, that that's the only thing valuable about me as a human being by, like, the broader society. And I've, like, had to claw my way into prove otherwise, that I have something more to say. And I'm grateful for the opportunities that I've been given. Like, I cannot tell you how grateful I am to broadly Vice's women's division that no longer exists for giving me the opportunity to talk about what it feels like to be a vilified woman and to look at other women's stories of having gone through a similar kind of vilification process. Like, they didn't have to offer me that opportunity, and they did. And they allowed me to be a small voice of my own experience and to help other women tell their stories. And that feeling of satisfaction and fulfillment and meaningfulness is what kickstarted my ongoing career today. So this latest instance of people going, you know what? Amanda does have something to say about this, and there's more to her and her story than we gave her credit for. I feel so lucky. Like, I feel like there's so many people who do not ever get recognized, and there's no guarantee that their humanity is going to be recognized and their perspective recognized as valuable. But to have that finally happen, like, my husband has been in tears because he has been watching from the sidelines as people have systematically dismissed me as tabloid trash. And he has been deeply hurt by that. And so the opportunity to talk about not just what happened in Italy, but how I have been a victim of storytelling who has become a storyteller myself and who understands, like, the gravity of storytelling and what it means when we cast people as characters in morality plays. Like, that, this is, like, such a deep, deep thing that I've had to grapple with personally that I feel like I'm now being given the opportunity to discuss on a sort of broader arena.
The situation is still such that if you say Amanda Knox to someone, they're probably not going to say, oh yeah, the reporter for the West Seattle Herald. It's, you have a different association. And it's something that, it was a terrible thing that happened to you when you were very young. Mm-hmm. Is your goal to erase that association and be seen as, yes, that's part of me, but that is not all of me. It's not going to define me. Is your goal to redefine yourself to the world?
I mean, it's not to erase what that is, because I can't erase that it happened to me, and it is an important part of who I am. I think my goal is to, first of all, to be the one defining who I am to the world, and for my work to be what is the work that I've done since all of that happened, that is informed by what happened, to be what people think about when they think of me. Not to think of the accusation, but to think of the stuff that I've actually done. It's such, in a way, the bittersweet thing about being wrongly convicted is, it's so crystal clear to me that I should not be defined by something I didn't do, and that I should be defined by things that I did do. So I like the sort of goal.
Seems like basic fairness to me. Yes.
It seems like basic fairness. So I feel like if I just keep churning away and doing good work and trying to make good from a bad situation, that eventually that will define me more than the accusation and the infamy of a crime that I didn't commit.
And similarly, I guess, do you see the, paratraumatic stress disorder that you've described, is that just going to be a lifetime companion, you think? Or are you trying to find a way to actually put it behind you?
I mean, I'm trying to find a way to, maybe I'm fighting a losing battle, because in some ways I'm trying to change the world around me. I want the world to understand that the way that we treat people who are accused of crimes and who have been found innocent, but we continue to sort of put them in the box of this like infamy and the accusation, like that's not fair and it's not nice and we shouldn't do it. On the other hand, I feel like the best psychological work anyone can do is to be a mindful witness of whatever experience they have, and to feel like you don't need to change the world around you in order to have a fulfilling life. So it's this balancing act of wanting to change the world for the better, but also not needing to, so that you can be happy and fulfilled.
Well, that's a button. That's a good closer. That's Amanda Knox. Her podcast is called Labyrinths. I keep thinking about what Amanda carries with her, what she always must carry. The trauma of her roommate's murder, the trauma of that time in jail, of course, the abuse that happened there, the names she was called, murder being only one of many, and the knowledge that, imagine knowing that your name is forever linked to a horrific murder that probably some people still think you committed. And then you're in your 20s, and you have to go forward and carry that weight with you. You got no choice. Amanda didn't ask for any of it, but she has to move forward. That's what happens for any of us with trauma of any shape or size. You go on. Damaged, certainly, but you go on. And people who don't understand, often people who've never had to deal with anything horrible, will say, oh, you're so brave. But that's never the point. It doesn't take bravery to participate in linear time. It just happens. And in order to exist, you go on. The question is, in what way do you go on? Amanda Knox's answer? With thoughtful deliberation. That's what I noticed. In the nearly 7 years since her exoneration, she has appeared places, she has talked about what happened, but she's done so carefully and selectively. And when she does it, she does so honestly and thoughtfully. It's good self-care. Okay, well, let's take a moment to get our heads together in a meditation moment with Laura House. Hello, Laura.
Hello.
And I say moment because I thought about saying minute, but moment doesn't seem as time restrictive. Because I think if it was minute, I'd suddenly be stressed about going over or under.
Now it feels like a weird appointment. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, now it feels like some sort of magical pause in the world.
I like the idea of moment too, that it's like, it is a moment, and maybe it's a moment and then another moment, but you were just really taking a moment, taking a break, taking some amount of time that's up to your discretion for yourself to just kind of check out and be not worried, not upset, not flipped out for a little bit of time.
Oh, it sounds so appealing. Let's dive into it.
So it's super easy. Get somewhere that you can close your eyes safely. So we're not driving.
Pull the car over.
Please. Sit in your chair, your sofa, wherever you are. And close your eyes. And then you just notice your breath. And you don't have to try to control it or make it better or slower or anything. Just notice it. It's already doing its thing. And you may also notice that you're having thoughts. That's fine. That's normal. We're not trying to get rid of thoughts. Essentially, just notice your breath. And you can notice that you're also having thoughts. And when it feels like all your attention is on your thoughts, just go back to noticing your breath. Just let go. Okay, you can go ahead and open your eyes slowly, sort of come back into it, hopefully refreshed.
You know what I love about this is so much of life is spent trying. You know, you're trying to accomplish something. You're trying to figure something out. You're trying to make the most of whatever it is you're doing. And I find I get the most out of the meditation when I just stop trying to do something. It's just a glorious little respite, a little break.
A tiny victory, you might say.
A tiny victory, one might say.
Now, I feel the same, and it's why there are meditation practices that are about concentration, and I really love the letty go-y kind of just like, for one moment in the day, can I just let go and be? And there's something totally glorious about that.
And when you start your own meditation only podcast, is it going to be called the Letty Goey?
I'll put it on the list.
Okay.
The Letty Goey.
Laura House from the Tiny Victories podcast. You can find more of her at laurahouse.com. Laura, thanks.
Thank you.
Next time on Depression Mode, when "aw yeah" becomes "oh no."
People who are depressed are often thinking about other things. They're distracted, or they're worried about what their body looks like. They're worried whether their partner is being pleasured. So if you don't have the motivation to engage in sex, and when you do, you have trouble becoming aroused, all of the stages of the sexual response can be negatively impacted.
The frustrating effect of depression, anxiety, and trauma on your sex life, and what to do about it. Let's do very concise credits this week. We depend on your donations, no show. Donating, easy and painless. MaximumFun.org/join. My book, The Hilarious World of Depression, is helpful and even fun. Buy it. Write reviews of this show and give us 5 stars. It helps. The Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 for free at 1-800-273-TALK. The Crisis Text Line, also free, always available. Text HOME to 741-741. Electric mail address is depressmode@maximumfun.org. Please electric mail us. Facebook group, Preshies. Twitter is @DepreshPod. Substack, search for Depresh Mode. My Twitter, at John Moe. Hi, credits listeners. Depresh Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out, building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hi, I'm Christy from North Little Rock, Arkansas. You are not a burden. Stay above ground.
Depresh Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.